This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Greetings, listeners. It's time for the May episode of Radio Astronomy. I'm news editor Ezzy Pearson, and I'm joined on the podcast today by staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later, Ian will be telling you our top tip for what to see in this month's night sky. But for now, I'm going to take a look back at an event that happened 101 years ago on the 26th of April. Two scientists named Harlow Shapley and Heber Curtis got together to discuss one of the most pressing issues in astronomy at the time. Just how big is our galaxy, the Milky Way, and how far away is it from its neighbours? 100 years ago this May, the pair of them published a paper discussing the views that were in that debate. So what actually was this event? It's since become known as something called the Great Debate. It took place at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History. And that paper that was released 100 years ago in May was in the Bulletin of National Research Council. But what were they actually discussing?
It's ultimately about what they called Spira Nebulae, isn't it? And whenever I was first sort of looking at really proper sort of like historical astronomy, specifically the Great Leviathan at Parsons Town, you know, Lord Ross's huge telescope in Birr Castle in the Irish Midlands.
Yeah, that's absolutely huge.
I know. And reading about, you know, some of his observations, and they kept talking about like nebulae, when I was like, but don't they mean galaxies? And this is like, you know, like years ago before I could have understood what the problem was. And the issue was that they had known about these sort of fuzzy patches in the sky for hundreds of years. I think it was like the 1700s, they started like sort of cataloguing nebulae, but that's what they called them. They called them nebulae. And they didn't yet
know. So in the 17th century, 1610, I think it was, Galileo invented the telescope. And then it took about 100 years for it to kind of progress to the stage where they could actually really begin to see these, what they at the time called spiral nebulae, and what we now know as spiral galaxies.
Indeed. And that's part of what the Great Debate was about, really, wasn't it? It's like, what are these spiral nebulae? And ultimately, the Great Debate was sort of saying, how big is the Milky Way, and is the Milky Way it? Is the Milky Way basically the universe, or is the universe much bigger? And are these spiral nebulae actually what was the word? It was Immanuel Kant.
Island universes.
Yes. Which was coined by Immanuel Kant, I think, in the 18th century. And he, the German philosopher, and he also believed that there were sort of extragalactic entities. But yeah, that's ultimately how the Great Debate came about, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there were two astronomers who are kind of on opposing sides. They, of course, weren't the only people who held this views. There was kind of one of those things in any facet of science, every scientist is going to have their own unique take on exactly where it is. But broadly speaking, there were kind of two churches. And Harlow Shapley, he was of the opinion that these spiral nebula were quite small, but were quite close to the Milky Way. There is a sort of misconception that he thought that these nebulae were actually inside the Milky Way. He didn't. Even then, they knew that the nebulas were probably, the galaxies were probably outside of our own Milky Way. But he came to this conclusion. You know, he was an astronomer. He was a scientist. This was all based on the information they had available during the day. And so he'd looked at globular clusters. So globular clusters are kind of like these big balls of stars that hang around. They're smaller than a galaxy, but there's still quite a lot of stars in them. They tend to be found around the outskirts of bigger galaxies. And by looking at these, he found Cepheid variable stars. And Cepheid variable stars are really interesting because they are variable, so they change how bright they are over time. And exactly how bright they are and that period with which it changes depends on how exactly bright they are. So how absolute, their absolute brightness. And if you know how bright something actually is and how bright something looks to you here on Earth, you can compare those two things and work out how far away they are. So Cepheid variables are great at judging distances when you're looking at things like globular clusters. And these measurements found out that these globular clusters were about 200,000 light years away. And so when you looked at those and compared them to where they thought spiral nebulae were, they got to this kind of the spiral nebulae must be pretty close by on the same sort of par of it.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because what you were saying there about Shapley was that there is that misconception that it was solely about, that the debate was solely about are these galaxies within the Milky Way, or are they nebulae within the Milky Way, or are the galaxies out with the Milky Way? And there was an interesting passage that I'd found from his paper, from Shapley's paper, and he sort of said, even if spirals fail as galactic systems, there may be elsewhere in space stellar systems equal to or greater than ours, as yet unrecognized and possibly quite beyond the power of existing optical devices and present measuring scales. And also that he wasn't actually arguing that the spiral nebulae were inside the Milky Way, but that they were sort of nearby. So he said that they were not members of our galactic system. I prefer to believe that they are not composed of stars at all, but are truly nebulous objects. So that was really the difference between the debate. But I think that the more you sort of look into the Great Debate, the more you sort of realize that on paper it looks like Curtis won, but actually probably no one won, or like science won.
Yeah. So there was also Herbert Curtis, who I should say that Shapley was from the Mount Wilson Observatory. Herbert Curtis was his opponent from the University of Virginia and the Lick Observatory. And he believed that these spiral nebula were very large, but very, very far away. So far away that a lot of astronomers just kind of refused to believe that these distances could exist, because when, I don't know if any of you have ever spent any time converting, you know, like how far away 300,000 light years is into kilometers, but it does mean you have to go and like have a little sit down and a cup of tea when you just realize exactly how big the universe is. So I can understand why they might be a little bit reticent to believe that.
Yeah.
He thought the Milky Way was a lot smaller, only around 30,000 light years across. So that's a tenth of what Shapley was saying, and that the sun was at its center. But he believed that these spiral nebulae were other galaxies, other star collections like the Milky Way, very large, very far away. And that view is what we now know to be true. These spiral nebulae are spiral galaxies. They do look just like the Milky Way. And in fact, he saw quite a lot of features in these spiral galaxies that he attributed to the Milky Way. So, for instance, he could see that these spiral galaxies had rings of dust around the middle. Occulting material is what he called it. Basically, that just means dust, and light can't get through the dust. So the light, you see it as a dark band across galaxies. And in our own Milky Way, he suggested, well, maybe that's why we haven't seen any of these spiral nebulae along the kind of Milky Way, because that's our plane looking through our own galaxy. There must be a bunch of dust, and it's cutting out our view to further away. So he got that bit right, that spiral galaxies are far away. But Shapley was much more on the money with regards to how big the Milky Way was. He still overestimated a bit. He was estimated the Milky Way was twice the size it was. But he also, Shapley said, the sun was on the outskirts of the Milky Way. And we now know that our sun, Sol, is somewhere on the Orion spiral arm on the outskirts of our Milky Way. And so they both got things right and they both got things wrong.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
Yeah, I think sort of, ultimately, I think it was a pretty sort of, amiable debate, you know, as they are, you know, it's not like it's sort of I'm right, you're wrong, you know, it's sort of, as I said, amiable debate and sort of discussing the matters and sort of both of them came up with ideas that did reshape how we think about the universe. I mean, on paper you'd think that Curtis had won, as he said, but I also read that that was potentially because he was like an experienced speaker and there being no microphones in the auditorium.
Yeah,
both speakers had to sort of project their voice. So ultimately, it maybe just came down to who appeared to be more convincing on the day. But I was, when I first started researching the Great Debate, I was sort of surprised to hear that Curtis was so much older, because you sort of think that the crux of Curtis's argument was probably correct, or at least more accurate, considering what we know today. You sort of think, well, he must have been the younger one. He must have been the sort of younger radical guy. But that wasn't the case at all.
No, it wasn't. It was kind of, you know, thinking outside the box. But this sort of, what I remember back when I was at university and learning, like there was basically being taught how to be a good scientist. This was sort of held up as one of those times of like, this is what scientific debate should be. You know, it's not going at each other or personal attacks. It's just basically like saying, this is my evidence. This is your evidence. Let's have a look at them and try and work out what's true. Mm. And as is often the case, it's like some views have some truth in them. Other views have other truth in them. And it's you work together and eventually get more detail and observations and evidence comes to light. And sometimes, you know, evidence that you previously had gets proved wrong. So, for instance, on Shapley's side of the argument, which was the galaxies are small and close by, he had a colleague called Adrian van Manen, who had measured the rotation of these spiral nebula. He measured how fast he thinks they are spinning, because galaxies, as we now know, are spinning. And he found that if his measurements were correct, then they would be rotating faster than the speed of light if they were huge and remote, which is, as we know, impossible. You can't go faster than the speed of light. So they have to be closer and smaller by to account for those rotation speeds that he saw. It later turned out that his measurements that he'd made and that Shapley had based some of his arguments on weren't right. He'd made a mistake. It hadn't measured it properly. No one else was able to replicate those results. So it's just that kind of, you have to keep looking and keep observing and find out what the truth is.
Don't we also know now, though, that his sort of claim to have been able to observe the rotations of those galaxies, that's not possible, or it wasn't possible then. So what was it that he saw? Because like I seriously doubt like he just made it up. You know, he must have just made like a real mistake.
Yeah, it's, well, people do. Yeah. Or you mistake something, or you. I'm not 100% sure if it was ever discovered exactly what his mistake was, but you know, people forget to account for stuff all the time.
Mm.
You know. Like when people discovered this is actually one that goes the other way around, but when people discovered the CMB, the cosmic microwave background radiation, it took them ages because they kept trying to discount stuff that was based on Earth, and it didn't occur to them that there might be something else out there that was making this kind of like background hiss. And they had to discount the pigeons that were living in the Horn. with, unfortunately, quite terminal ways, but for the pigeons involved. But they, you know, there's like, there's hundreds and hundreds of things that come into play when you're looking at various different aspects of astronomy. And it's just, you know, humans aren't perfect. Occasionally you miss something, or you forget something, or yeah, you don't quite have the eyepiece in the right place, or you've accidentally put in the wrong filter and not realized it. So there's loads of things that can happen.
Yeah, I mean, and also, even though sort of, you know, Curtis was proven to be most accurate in terms of what he thought the spiral nebulae were, that's almost sort of down to a mistake on his part, because he thought the Milky Way was really small. He thought it was only like 30,000 light years across, so it was sort of easy for him to conceive that they might be beyond the Milky Way.
Yeah.
So it's, but he was like, Shapley was more accurate in how big he thought the Milky Way was. So it's almost like Curtis got the right answer, but he got the right answer by the wrong method.
Yeah, it's kind of failing your way to success. So yeah, Curtis thought that the Milky Way was 30,000 light years across. The actual value is about 106,000 light years across. So four times larger than that, which is quite a big difference. Shapley was actually closer than Curtis was in terms of the size of the Milky Way. Though I should state that it's incredibly difficult to measure the size of something when you're inside it.
Yeah.
It's like if you're like trying to work out how wide a building is and you're standing outside of it, you can take a look at it and like measure the distance, like using your eyes, you can do quite a good gauge. If, however, you know, like you're sitting in a cupboard under the stairs.
In the dark,
you can't judge how big it is. Like you might be able to go, it's like, okay, well, if it's got a cupboard under the stairs this size, then maybe it's a house this size. But, you know, you're making assumptions and you're taking guesses. And yeah, it's a bit like that with trying to measure the Milky Way. We've gotten better at it over the years. The Gaia satellite, which is currently measuring the positions of the billion stars in the galaxy, is going to help us do that a lot. But it's tricky, and it's taken us a long time to kind of get to that degree of accuracy. Or what we think is that degree of accuracy.
The other measurement that Curtis calculated was the distance from the Milky Way to the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the nearest big galaxy. He thought it was 500,000 light years away, and this is where sort of the next part of the story comes in, because an astronomer called Edwin Hubble, who obviously doesn't really need that much introduction, calculated it to be three times further away, We now know it was, in fact, five times further away. So Andromeda Galaxy is 2.5 million light years away. But Hubble managed to get the distance a bit more accurate by saying it was 1.5 million light years away. And then this is where Cepheid variable stars come in again, because it was he who basically photographed the Andromeda Galaxy and was able to was able to sort of more accurately calculate the distance using these standard candles, as they're known.
Yes, he managed to show, like, take a photo which showed that there were individual stars in the Andromeda Nebula, the Andromeda Galaxy. And he couldn't see every single star. Like, a lot of it was still just a kind of, like, glowy blur, but he could pick out a couple of the few brighter ones, particularly towards the edges. And one of these happened to be a Cepheid variable, so he could measure the distance. It's still not easy, you know, trying to measure the light curve of something that's several million light years away with the technology available in the 1920s. Because he made this discovery in October 1923.
Yeah, unbelievable. But apparently he, because obviously the Great Debate had been over, was like two years prior to that. And Hubble actually wrote to Shapley, and he said, he wrote him a letter in 1924, and he said, you'll be interested to hear that I have found a Cepheid variable in the Andromeda Nebula, Andromeda Galaxy. Enclosed is a copy of the light curve, which, rough as it is, shows the Cepheid characteristics in an unmistakable fashion. And Shapley apparently said, here is the letter that destroyed my universe.
Quite literally. His version of the universe went out the window, so...
Yeah. And Curtis apparently said, I have always held this view, and the recent results by Hubble on variables and spirals seem to make the theory doubly certain. So sort of quite humble in his sort of relative victory there.
It does seem to be, you know, kind of like, as you said, it was a very, like, it gets told as like this, the great debate between these two people. But even if you actually look at the event, it wasn't really even technically a debate. Like, they didn't get to respond to each other. It was just one person got 40 minutes to speak, the other person got 40 minutes to speak, and then they had some questions, and they weren't actually responding to each other's arguments. So that was one of the reasons why they released the paper, which is 100 years ago this May, which is why we are. That's why we are talking about it right now.
I did find an interesting... Where was the website? It was the National Academy of Sciences has some really good material on the Great Debate. And one of the things they have is a scanned PDF of the press release that went out to journalists talking about what the, about this amazing debate that was come up. And it's headlined, How Many Universes Are There? which is quite funny because, as you and I get press releases, you know, tens of press releases every day, and they're always trying to catch your attention. They're always trying to, like, you know, talk about Star Wars or how some stars like Star Wars or something like that. They're always trying to hook, and this is a great hook, isn't it? How many universes are there? And it says, this evening two California astronomers will discuss the size of the universe and present their views as to whether or not there's only one or several universes before the National Academy of Sciences, which is now in session in Washington. And one interesting bit is it says, Dr. Shapley's views will be followed by the discussion of Dr. Hayward D. Curtis of the Lick Observatory, who will defend the older view that the Milky Way is approximately of the dimension suggested by Newcomb, about 30,000 light years in diameter, with the spiral nebulae regarded as very probably individual galaxies of island universes like ours. Thus, there may be a million other universes, each having 3 billion stars. Inhabitants of these numerous universes would see our Milky Way as a spiral nebula. That's really cool. Just thinking back to that, you know, like all that discovery lay ahead, and you know, this was the press release that was going out to sort of gauge journalists and sort of pique their interest. It's fascinating reading stuff like that.
Yeah, and it also, again, it's this kind of, it shows you just how much even like the terminology has changed, because, you know, we've spent this entire podcast going nebulae, which are also galaxies, but they called them nebulae, and then they're talking about universes, whereas for us, you know, we have, like, for us, the universe is basically everything that is within space. And then you get into various other theories with multiverses where there are other universes. But, like, everything that we can encounter here is our universe. And it's just this kind of trying to get your head around of just, like, what a different view of the universe and the world that we live in was back then. Because, you know, I've always grown up knowing that it's like, oh, yes, I live on planet Earth and it goes around the sun and it's in the Milky Way, which is a galaxy. And then there are other galaxies, you know, got taught that at school. And it's just this kind of like how much of a shift it must have been for the people around there to just say it's like, oh, no, like this is just one of untold billions. It's like it's tiny in the grand scheme of things. That just must have been such a shift in people's imaginations.
But I mean, even in our lifetime, I remember at school being taught that the most likely scenario for the end of the universe was that the universe is expanding, but the expansion is slowing and it will start contracting. And we know that that's not the case because of dark energy. And the of course, the other thing that we were taught at school, well, I certainly was, Izzy, is that Pluto was a planet. You know,
oh, yeah, that one is still up for debate if you talk to the New Horizons team.
Which sort of reminds me of that another great debate that occurred, obviously, over the past few years was, I don't know if you saw it, but it was live streamed on YouTube, you know, as things are. It was between Alan Stern, who was the principal investigator of the New Horizons mission to Pluto, and Ron Eckers of the International Astronomical Union. And that was a debate about should Pluto be a planet, and it was sort of the same as the great debate. You know, they had a certain amount of time allocated to sort of put their view across, and that's fascinating. If you just Google that, you know, Pluto debate, Alan Stern, Ron Eckers, you'll find the 2-hour video on YouTube. It's absolutely fascinating. But it sort of reminds me of that. Thinking back to the great debate and what it might have been like at the time.
As I said, it's part of what science is kind of standing up for, you know, like, here is my evidence and here's what I think, and somebody else coming back and having these debates and these conversations. But always looking, kind of basing it on evidence and what you can see. That's kind of half of like what science has always been. It's making those debates. So looking at the evidence, supporting your argument for it, listening to other people's, and kind of trying to find your way to the truth. And if any of the listeners at home would like to find out more about the Great Debate of 1920, then pick up the May issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we have an article all about it there.
And now it's time for this month's stargazing tip. In May, we welcome the return of the planet Venus to the evening sky. And as the month progresses, see if you can spot the planet just after sunset. It will appear as a bright evening star-like object about 20 minutes after the sun sets. But you will need a pretty flat and clear west-northwest to northwest horizon. And it may initially seem like a bit of a challenge to spot, but once you've seen it, you won't be able to miss it. And I find a good thing to do is, if you're unsure, is to download a stargazing app or to your smartphone or tablet, and that'll help you spot it. And it's not cheating, honestly. sometimes we all need a little bit of help. But this does come with a word of warning. Make sure not to look directly at the sun with the naked eye, as doing so could seriously harm your vision. But that's just a sort of a safety tip that we have to give, because you're observing so close to sunset. Just wait until the sun is safely set and as darkness falls, you'll be able to spot Venus shining brightly in the evening sky.
So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about the Great Debate in the May issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we also guide you through the best globular clusters to see this season, give you a beginner's guide to using a DSLR camera for astronomy, and take a tour down the coast to see the celestial wonders that can be found there. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Brittany Colley. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skynightmagazine.com or head to iTunes, Acast, Spotify, or your favourite podcast provider.